Hi, this is Alan Shartok. Today, I'm really delighted to have NPR's Deborah Amos in studio with us. Deborah Amos is an award-winning foreign correspondent for NPR, has been named the 2013 James H. Ottaway Sr. Professor of Journalism at the State University of New York at New Paltz. WAMC, for its part, has interviewed each of the Ottaway professors during or before their tenure, and we have always been delighted. But this is a special honor because this is one of our own, and we are very pleased. The Ottaway Professorship is named for the founder of Ottaway Newspapers, now the Dow Jones Local Media Group, which operates print and online community media franchises in seven states. The flagship newspaper of the chain is the Times-Herald Record in Middletown. Amos has joined the faculty in the spring of 2013 for a two-week residency of workshops and guest speaking on broadcast and multimedia journalism and international reporting. Amos's expertise is in reporting from the Middle East. She has reported extensively on the Arab Spring and the sectarian conflicts in the region. In 2012, she was one of the only American journalists allowed into war-torn Syria. Deborah Amos won a 2013 Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Award for her role in NPR's coverage of the bloody uprising in Syria. In 2010, she received the Edward R. Murrow Lifetime Achievement Award from Washington State University. She won the 2009 Edward Weintil Prize for Diplomatic Reporting from Georgetown University. She was a part of a team of NPR reporters who won a 2004 Alfred I. DuPont Columbia Award for coverage of Iraq. She's been named a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University, a Shorenstein Fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She was a visiting professor at Princeton University in 2012. Amos started her journalism career in NPR in 1977 as a director for Weekend All Things Considered. From 1979 to 1985, she worked on radio documentaries. Her 1982 documentary, Father Cares, The Last Jonestown, won several awards, including a DuPont Columbia Award and the Prix Italia from 1985 until 1993. She reported for NPR from London and the Middle East. Amos then spent a decade in television news, reporting for ABC's Nightline and World News Tonight and PBS's Now with Bill Moyers and Frontline. Deborah Amos was the author of Eclipse of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East, Public Affairs 2010 is the publisher, and Lines in the Sand, Desert Storm, and the Remaking of the Arab World, Simon & Schuster, 1992. Whew! Welcome, Deborah Amos.
I think the same thing. Yeah. It sounds like the obit.
Well, no. The obit will be, you know, much longer than that, and you have a long way to go before you get an obit. Okay. So,
thank you.
So first of all, I love the fact that you're at New Paltz, which, of course, is a place where I've taught for 40 years, and I have a very special relationship with it, and I love the place, and I love their journalism program. And we've had James Ottaway here a number of times. We just did an hour like this one with him, and we think he's great. And so it all sort of comes together. So let's start biographically, which I always like to do so that people on the outside will know who they're listening to. Where'd you grow up?
Oh, boy. I grew up in New Jersey and in Florida. And probably that growing up in Florida explains a lot about why I want to be in the Middle East, or at least outside of the country. When you grow up in Florida, you are almost on another planet. And so what you want is to get out and get away.
Are we talking Gold Coast, Florida, or are we talking, you know, Porkchop, Florida?
Porkchop, St. Petersburg.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not exactly Porkchop. Porkchop is down by the Alabama line. When you go there, you know, the people still wearing white suits.
It might as well have been.
Deborah Amos, what did your parents do?
My dad was moved to Florida as part of the space race.
Really?
In the 1960s. And my mother was a nurse. And so we were transplants to Florida out of New Jersey. And I remember getting off the plane and thinking the air is awfully thick here. And it really was a place so different from the Northeast that I suppose you could say it was my first time as a foreign correspondent.
Interesting. What did you do when you got there? What were your hobbies?
Oh, boy, being outside, which is what you do a lot in Florida. You go to the beach at 11 o'clock because you're in double session schools.
Oh.
It's one of the worst education systems in the country. It certainly was back then. So your education happened by reading books, by being outside.
And by having smart parents.
And having smart parents.
and brothers and sisters?
I have one of each.
What do they do?
They do very normal things. One of them is a headhunter for a big corporation in America, and the other one sells Mercedes-Benz in Colorado.
Are they proud of their very accomplished sister?
They are, but they think I'm a little crazy. They have very normal lives, and I don't.
Well, are you crazy?
I don't think so. I think that early in my life, I did want to see the world, and NPR has allowed a master's and a PhD in exploring, and I am grateful for that because I've had a long and exciting career. I have been lucky enough to be acknowledged for that, and that's very nice, but the point of all of it was to be out there.
When you get on a plane, first class or in the back?
Are you kidding? I work for National Public Radio. And the good thing is I'm small, so I can fit in those seats.
Yeah.
10-hour flights to Turkey these days.
What's the scariest place you've ever been?
You know, I find that my mind erases all the ones from before. So the last scary place was Turkey. This last trip was particularly scary. I thought that I was in a safe place. We were coming back from Syria. We were at the Turkish border handing in my passport, and we were 50 feet away from a car bomb. This was the first time in my career that I saw a car bomb. I saw it explode. I saw all of the faces of the people in that brief, silent moment before people register what has happened. And all of the people we had been interviewing just 5 minutes before were dead. And I turned around and I could see that. I could see that all of the cars were scorched. And it was, according to Turkish authorities, it was an attack by the Syrian regime's intelligence service. There were a group of opposition political people who were on that board at the same time I was, unbeknownst to me. We were saved because we were under a concrete canopy, not touched at all, which is unusual in a car bomb. But the most unsettling part about that moment was thinking that you were safe, handing in a passport on the Turkish side. I'm done. You know, my day is done. I've done the scary part. Now I'm going home to file. And to have this happen at that moment. I was with a cameraman, a very tall guy for France 24, and he did something that was quite extraordinary. He turned around towards the explosion and began to film. And in that way, actually helped the Turkish authorities identify who the perpetrators were. He filmed them.
So the perpetrators were literally there?
It was not a suicide car bomb. It was an exploded car bomb. And some of the people who were involved in setting off that explosion were still on the scene. So we were asked to come and look at the video. All border posts now have cameras. We were there. We were caught on the video. And his video, when he turned around, because he was a tall guy, and filmed that scene behind us. The intelligence people in Turkey were able to identify some of those figures.
Well, isn't that a no-no that the Syrian regime, the Assad regime, would send people across the border to do this work?
Well, technically, yes, they were across the border, but no country has their passport control center exactly on the geographical line. So there's always this no man's land between any border post. And so the fence is where the bomb went off, and the fence was on the side where Syrian civilians' cars, trucks were trying to come into Turkey. And they had planted that car bomb at a place where they thought that these opposition people were on their way back into southern Turkey.
In my stream of consciousness way, and I hope you'll excuse it, Turkey becomes so fascinating to all of us because in the news recently, we see the president of the United States getting credit for having gotten an Israeli redialogue, if that's a good word, going. And now we find out that maybe it isn't as going as well as we read on the front page of the New York Times. And we see Secretary of State Kerry having to re-energize the whole thing. And Turkey itself is one of the most fascinating places in the world, right? Because in the old days, the army really was the sort of backbone of the country. And if something happened they didn't like, if a regime came in, they kicked them out. But now you have, you know, basically a Muslim prime minister running on that basis. And do you have any observations as to whether or not that new reorientation within Turkey has spelled a different kind of relationship between, for example, Israel and Turkey or Turkey and the United States?
I think all of those things are true. It is a reorientation, not so much because the prime minister is a Muslim, because, in fact, everybody in Turkey is a Muslim one way or the other. It's a very small Christian community.
Except for the old days, right? I don't want to interrupt, but in the old days, there was a secular state.
Very secular state. The AKP, the rise of the AKP is a very important thing that has happened in the region. It is seen as a model certainly in Arab Spring countries as a way that you can accommodate Islam and politics without being extreme. This is a country that has no oil and yet is the 17th largest economy in the world. And when you look at the models for how you run a country that is Islamic and wants to be democratic, what are your models? Iran, this is a country that has oil and yet cannot somehow accommodate its people. And so Turkey is a very important model for the region. I think that the relationship between Israel and Turkey was severely damaged. The president has moved it in a different direction. You can't do that with one
trip.
Our president. And I think Obama put himself on the line to do that. I think that it will mend itself because at this moment, Syria is such a crisis for both countries that they need each other. And I keep thinking when I go that we're not looking at all these other events that actually are swirling around the new relationship. And it will be rocky, but it is moving in the right direction for the first time in 2 years between Israel and Turkey. Turkey has just made some sort of accommodation with a man called Öcalan, who is the head of the PKK. It's what we call in the United States the terrorist wing of the Kurds. And that is also a historic accommodation. It means that it might be easier for Kurdish factions within Syria to move against the regime because they're going to be on the same side as Turkey. These are all these little events that are changing in the region as the Syria crisis essentially changes politics in all of its neighbors.
Deborah Amos, I wonder if you would—this is wonderful to talk to you, first of all. I would wonder if you could talk to us just a little bit more about that and to expand on a little bit. So we know that the Kurds have always been really enemies, you know, of the Turks, and they've been uncompromising, you know, about that. And so you're telling me something I didn't know, that there is this accommodation now.
In a funny way, the accommodation happens— because Turkey wants to be in the EU and had to suspend the death penalty. When they capture Öcalan, believe me, they would have loved to have executed him, but they could not. And so he has been in jail and he has remained a political figure that the Turks must deal with. It's taken a long time, but you're seeing a bit of a breakthrough. Let me tell you something else about the Kurds. Northern Iraq, Kurdistan. Is also becoming very accommodating to Turkish business interests. Turkey is the biggest business partner in northern Iraq. In fact, the Turks have decided that the Kurds are a better bet than Baghdad. And so they have canceled many of their oil deals with Baghdad to go with Kurdistan. You are seeing such an interesting realignment in that part of the world that doesn't get a lot of coverage. And I often think it's too complicated. It's too complicated to explain. And that's why you don't see a whole lot of press.
And that's your job.
It's important. It is my job. This is a huge story. Turkey, Syria, Israel. And so you tend to focus on what you can explain easily. Often, you know, you sort of wait on the Kurd story until it really gets big. Peter Kenyon has been doing a lot of reporting on it. It's there. But I haven't seen any long piece yet that explains, hey, there's just been a bit of a realignment and we need to put this into our calculations.
And how do you decide when to go or where to go? Is that assignment, editor, or do you wake up in the morning and scratch your head and say, off to Turkey?
In a way, it is a combination of all of those things. So Doug Roberts, who is the Middle East editor, we call him our beloved editor. He is an Arabic speaker. He worked for years for Voice of America, so he has enormous judgment and experience.
Those are the guys we on the other side of the radio never know.
Exactly. Right. And they are the unsung heroes. And so we talk it over with him. June of last year is when I said, look, I think I would like to do a lot of work in southern Turkey. It seems like a place to be. At that point, there was only one border post that was open that the rebels had taken. Now there are five.
Mm.
I can cross into Syria like I'm crossing into Canada.
But it's dangerous.
It is dangerous, except it's a roulette game. It is not dangerous to walk across the border. What is dangerous is there are daily regime airstrikes on villages. So you don't know...
Assad strikes.
So you don't know if the village that you're in will be the one that gets it today. And recently there have now been Scud strikes, which are surface-to-surface missiles. I've been scratching my head thinking, is there another government that has used surface-to-surface missiles on its own population? And I really can't come up with another example. These are hugely destructive and not precise weapons. But the Assad regime has been firing them into northern neighborhoods from southern Damascus. That's what the danger is, that you don't know if that day is your day.
Well, the day that the bomb blew up.
Car bomb.
Yeah.
You just don't know. And that's what the danger is. But to simply walk across the border, you hand your passport to a Turkish official. He stamps you out. You go to the other side, to the Syrian side of the border, where the rebels have set up a pretty good border operation. One of them has been done by a former cigarette smuggler, so he knows a lot about borders. He went to the refugee camps. He recruited government employees, school teachers, people who know how to tuck in their shirt and know what a computer is, and he recruited them, and they run the border post. And this is true in all four of them. They're run by rebels on the other side. And it is remarkably normal when you go from the Turkish side to the Syrian side, and then you're in Syria, and then, of course, you are taking the same risks that every Syrian is taking. Will I be bombed today?
And how much do you think the Assad regime knows about people like you? In other words, whether or not they're ticked off at you, you know.
Oh, I know they are.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely
right.
Know they are.
So do they target you?
I don't think that they can. I don't think that they are that good. They have done it before in Homs. A year ago, they killed Marie Colvin because they could target her satellite signal. They knew where she was, and she stayed too long. And I'm sure that she didn't know how accurate they could be on looking for that satellite signal. And my office advises us all the time, if you put up your satellite, have it down in 15 minutes because they can find you. We don't use our satellite gear when we cross the border. How I know that they're annoyed with me is in 2011 and 2012, I had four official visas. When I called recently asking for another one, a fixer I know in Baghdad wrote and said, I was so embarrassed to find out that you'd been in Turkey five times. You know they don't like that. And what it meant is, if you cross the border into the rebel zone, you are out of the running for an official legal visa into Damascus. They just won't let you do it. So what he says is, you know, if you can find someone with a clean passport, they can come. And my answer to that is, I won't let them determine what my coverage is. I will go where I want to go. And if that costs me an official visa, then so be it.
Well, do you ever have, Deborah Amos, do you ever have nightmares about ending up in an Assad jail?
I don't. I really don't. Look, here's what we all say. It's like whistling in the dark. We all say, especially when someone's kidnapped, well, of course they, you know, did something wrong, and you find out what that is, and you say, I would never do that. Of course you're playing the odds. Everybody plays the odds. There are journalists who have ended up, I think there are two, we don't know specifically if they are being held by the regime, but the indications are that that is what has happened to them, Jim Foley and Austin Tice. And, you know, did they make mistakes? Maybe they did. Maybe they stayed in too long. Maybe they went to the wrong places. I'd like to think I don't do that. But journalism is a risk. To be a witness in a conflict is a risk. That's what you do.
And that's the job of the journalist.
It's our job.
And that's what you're telling young people. When you tell them at New Paltz or at Harvard, and you look at their faces, what's your sense of comprehension as to what it all means?
I think some of them understand it and understand why one might do it. and even want to do it themselves. And I've had a student from my Princeton time who took a year off and went on a walkabout and has been reporting on the blog that I asked all of my students to set up. And I just got an email, a Skype call from him that said, I know you told me not to do this, but I did cross the border into Syria just on the other side. And the touching part from him was, he wrote me and he said, I met a man and his wife needs an operation in 24 hours or she'll die. I can put it on my blog, but if you could place it, maybe she can get some help. And the hard part for me was to say to him, the cavalry is not coming. Journalism is not like that. You can't save individual lives. That's not our job. You witness, you hope that you can change people's minds over time, but you can never save an individual life. It's almost impossible.
Well, it's an interesting question. You're standing there, Deborah Amos, world-famous correspondent for NPR. Your philosophy has just been laid out for your students, and yet you can, at some point in your life, find somebody who is in the line of fire, grab her or him, throw them to the ground, and save a life.
I can, and I have. I can't do it. You can't save a life by publishing a story. That is very, very difficult and very rare. That is not the job of journalism. The job of journalism is to put those stories out there so people can't say, I didn't know. And then they make their decisions based on that.
And yet every once in a while you see a story about a kid who's lost an eye or an arms and legs, and that's a different kind of journalism, and as a result of being a witness to that,
somebody writing that,
people can do that.
But not within 24 hours. Yeah.
What's the difference between the Harvard kid and the New Paltz kid?
Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. One day, they all came to my office, and they had tons of questions, and I found them curious. I've listened to their work. Lisa Phillips, who is a professor.
She worked here.
Yes, she did. A great journalism professor at New Pulse. I can see her work in their work, and they're good. Many of them can go on to be journalists as they graduate. They're smart kids. They are smart kids.
So the journalism field is sort of in desperate shape right now. You walk into a newsroom, which used to have 100 desks, and see three guys at the end of the room. What's your advice for them?
That's the hardest part. You know, no one at that age is going to have a career as my generation did. I worked for three companies over these many years. I had health insurance. I progressed in my salary from my 20s to now. I think that there is the lowest bar ever for getting into the profession. You can write your blog. You can work for nothing for a lot of internet outlets. The question that is the hardest to answer is, can I be a journalist at 40? Can I begin at 20 and continue into my 40s? And can you assure me that I can raise a family, I can get health insurance, I can have a career? You know, sometimes we used to joke that you have to marry another journalist. It's the only person that would understand you. Now we say, don't you dare. Better to marry a banker because we're like artists.
Who did you marry?
I married a journalist.
And when you go abroad and cross that border and are almost blown up by a bomb, what does your wonderful husband have to say to you on the telephone?
You know, he understands more than anyone. He's Rick Davis, NBC News correspondent, war correspondent for years. We met in Beirut in 1982 in the middle of a war zone. So there is no one who worries more because he knows, and there's no one who is more understanding because he knows. And when he knows that I'm off on some dangerous pursuit, he might get a little annoyed, but his second thought is always, yeah, I would have done the same thing in your place. And I think that a war correspondent does understand another war correspondent at what drives you and what makes you take those risks. Limited risks, smart risks, let me say. I am not reckless. And I think that another correspondent understands that.
Let's talk a little bit, if we can, about Israel.
Okay.
I'm fascinated by the way in which one has to cover that. When I'm in Israel, you know, or have been in Israel, the conversation among Israelis is dramatic, to put it mildly. You know, there are peaceniks, there are conservatives, there are, you know, ultra-religious and the others. And we just saw this new film in which the former heads of Shin Bet are basically saying, you know, we did it, but it didn't work out the way we thought it would. You've been over there. I've had several calls here from people. As soon as we take up the subject, somebody in the American Jewish community or the American Arab community will take offense at whatever we say. Do you find that?
I always think that's when I'm doing my job, when they're both equally mad at me. It's a very passionate subject, and people are entrenched often, I find, in their thinking, and so you will offend both sides. That's the point. You need to be right in the middle so that both of them are mad at you. It's been very interesting to watch how the Syrian conflict has moved people in different ways. For the first time, you see the Palestinians are siding with the revolution rather than Assad. Here is a leader who fancies himself, you know, the protector of the Palestinians, as did his father for all of these years. And yet, when it comes right down to it, the Palestinians have sided with those who want to unseat him. I was fascinated by an event on the Golan Heights. There were a group of rebels who were all Palestinians who detained, kidnapped, you use your word, a group of UN peacekeepers who were on the Golan. In Israel, a correspondent, Shira Frankel, got their telephone numbers and called them across the Golan. And they were quite comfortable speaking to a reporter in Israel and saying, well, you know, we don't want to go all the way to the border because we know it will upset the Israelis. It's a little too tense for them. But we mean them no harm. We are just anti-Assad rebels, and that's why we took these UN guys. Can you imagine that happening 5 years ago? I think that this revolt in Syria has really changed so many people in the way that they see the world and the sides that they took. For the first time ever, we have Hamas. Hamas, who had their headquarters in downtown Damascus, they have now come back and they are training the revolutionaries in Syria against Assad. That's unthinkable. So it's a moment in the region where so much is fluid. As dangerous and as horrible as all of this is, you have seen the Israeli prime minister and the prime minister of Turkey come back together, say things that neither one of them thought they could say 6 months ago, 8 months ago. But it's Syria that's doing this.
Now, what about American, Deborah Amos, what about American foreign policy? You know, we have been sympathetic to the rebels in each of these cases, I think it's fair to say. And yet, we may be sorry. We may be sorry that we did that because some of these people, the government considers Hamas to be terrorists and the rest, some of these people could turn on us rather viciously.
That is correct. This is a different time in the region. You know, we were comfortable with dictators. It was so easy. It was one telephone number and we were done. Now you have a diplomacy that has to be more nimble, more nuanced. We had to make a very quick pivot to decide that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was okay. And for years, it was not. We didn't talk to the Brotherhood. I remember being in Egypt 10 years ago when it was explained to me that if I wanted to talk to the man who talked to the Brotherhood for the Americans, I should go to the British Embassy and meet a Pakistani Brit, and that was the connection. That's how we did it. We don't do it that way anymore. We talk to them directly. And in fact, they're not doing very well, are they? These are people who have been in the opposition for 50 years, who actually ran things, who had a political organization, who dreamed of running the country for all these years, and now they get their big chance. And what do? They put comedians under pressure for insulting the president, the very thing that—
I'm talking about Egypt now.
I'm talking about Egypt, the very thing that the Muslim Brotherhood president had done to him. So I think that for us, it is way too early to say we may be sorry. We are watching a generational transformation. The way the system worked before was unsustainable. And that has been made so clear in these uprisings and what these uprisings were about. They were about economies that couldn't sustain a youth bulge. We are talking about a region that 60% of the population is under 30. And the economies simply couldn't sustain what's happened.
So I know you haven't got a crystal ball in front of you, but what happens in a situation like that? You've got a guy who came in Egypt as a great sort of hero, the hope, And now many of the same people who came out to protest before are out protesting him. Is there any hope for secularism in any of these places?
I think if the Muslim Brotherhood fails, you're going to see a lot of secularism, or at least people who say we want a separation. We want some separation between religion and governance. And the region may be moving this way, but I think that we are in a process. There is no way that you can have a crystal ball. This is a once in a millennium moment in the Middle East that is far, far from over. And, you know, it comes at a time when the United States is moving away from the dependence on oil in the Middle East. Our allies still certainly do, Europe and Japan. And so it's not like we can turn our back on this dependence. But we, as a country, Saudi Arabia, I think, is number six now in who we buy our oil from. This new way of governing in the Middle East plays itself out has, you know, 20 years to go. I find it fascinating to watch those who, and I'd like to challenge a bit on whether a Muslim Brotherhood president was in fact the hope or the default choice at a moment of rebellion by primarily young people who started it, in some ways a social media movement who had no idea how to organize politically. Mm-hmm. So revolutions get hijacked by the guys who are organized. And in Egypt, that is what happened. The Brotherhood had an on-the-ground organization, and they were able to move into a vacuum. And now we are seeing, can they govern? Will they learn? I don't know.
Americans are led by the press a lot. And if we see on television a woman being whipped in the middle of an Iraqi street or an Iranian street, and then somebody says to us, we have to go into these places to save those people. How much responsibility does journalism, and you know better than anybody, have for American attitudes?
I think less than when I started in this business.
Really?
Yes, the media is so fractured now with cable television. You know, National Public Radio, I think in some ways the reason that our audience continues to build is because of that fracturing. We're the one, you know, tentpole of news. 30 million people listen and more every week because I think there is some hunger for real news. But we are at a moment in this country that local newspapers are fading away, or if they survive, they do it by covering local news. Nothing wrong with that, but there's no national news and international news on top of that. So you have to seek it out. You have to want to do that. I don't know about you, but my dad, at dinner, we watched the evening news. Yeah, that's how I learned to do that.
Yeah, we did too. We weren't throwing plates at each other.
Yes, well, there's that. And I'm not sure if that happens as much in families. But I do meet students, not all of them, but I do meet students that have the news habit. I don't know how they get it, but they have it.
I'm very happy to hear this.
I find they do. They listen to NPR, they read the New York Times, and they watch Al Jazeera on their iPads because Al Jazeera gives them a hourly newscast that is visual, and they like that.
Hmm. We hear that fewer and fewer people are watching television. What does that mean to you?
I think it means that they're watching television on their iPads and nobody knows how to count that. And, you know, we have the same problem at National Public Radio. Nobody knows how to capture the audience that is streaming these radio programs on their computers. I run it into diplomats all the time and I get emails from them. I'm in Afghanistan. I'd heard your piece. Mm. I'm in, you know, Istanbul.
They're not counted.
They're not counted because we don't know how to do it.
Well, you seem to know how to. I don't want to get you involved in my personal fights. But NPR does seem to know how to count the people who are, the many, many people who are listening on the 24/5 stations here at WAMC, and we have to pay them for each of them. So somehow they do that.
So go back and argue that you can't count.
So somehow they do that well.
Yes, they do.
Right. What's next? What do you have in mind?
I will teach this week and next. Then I'm scheduled to go back out to the region. There's never a dull moment in Syrian coverage. Now the story has moved to the south. There are reports that someone, and it's not altogether clear whom, is
training rebels, have focused on defected officers, less radical than what we are seeing in northern Syria. There has clearly been, and we've seen it in YouTube videos, there are more sophisticated weapons that are going in. There has been a new offensive in the south, and it looks like the rebels are very close to taking the southern province of Deraa, where the revolution began in March of 2011. If you look at the maps that are now available on the internet, it is remarkable how small the regime presence is. And last week, we saw, yet again on YouTube, in the Syrian parliament, a parliamentarian stood up from Deraa and said, "Where's the army? What are you people doing? Why aren't you down there?" And they all shouted him down. "Don't tell us the truth. Stop talking about this." And it'll be another development in this story if there is a southern region that is rebel-controlled in the way that it is in the north. That means the regime's writ shrinks. They are moved back into Damascus. Mm. We could find ourselves in a stalemate, but it may take some pressure off of Jordan that already has some of the largest populations of refugees. In fact, one refugee camp is now the fifth largest city in the country, in Jordan.
You know, 30 years after it starts, we find out that the CIA played a huge role in a lot of the places, you know, that Americans weren't told about. They have, the regular Syrians have, the old Syrians have planes. We don't put a no-fly zone up, but the rebels get some ammunition and arms and the rest of it. How do you think these decisions are getting made? You know what I'm talking about? I mean, it's kind of vague, but how do we know who's running things?
That's a very good question, and I ask this all the time.
Sure.
I think that there's a public face of policy and then the one we can see on YouTube. The difference from the old days is there wasn't YouTube.
Right.
And so it took us 30 years to find out what the CIA did in Iran and, in fact, what American diplomats did in Syria. We engineered a coup, Miles Copeland,
sure,
in Syria, which is really not very well known in this country, but we did. Didn't go our way. But it's part of the history of diplomacy between the United States and Syria. There has clearly been a decision in some Arab capitals to back the rebels. And we know that because we are seeing the weapons. I think that there's no place that you will see a public statement, "Yes, we are funding." In fact, all governments deny that they are.
They don't give them airplanes.
I think that they will not give them airplanes. They will not give them surface-to-air missiles to shoot down airplanes. The lessons of Afghanistan are well known to all, that when we brought Stingers in and those people turned into Al-Qaeda and threatened civilian aircraft, that will never happen again. And so that, I think, will always be the red line for not only Arab governments, but Western governments that are backing the rebels.
Do you ever get the idea that, okay, I've done the Middle East, now I'd like to do Latin America?
I think I couldn't bear not knowing. There's something very satisfying about knowing a region.
How long have you been over there, basically?
Since 1982.
Yeah. To me, an old man, it seems like yesterday, 1982, but it's actually...
It's been a long time.
Long time.
And it's a learning curve. You know, you build and build and build and build.
And you make friends.
I have translators. I know their kids. I know them when they were babies. I now know them at college. I know their families. If we're there for the holidays, I spend them with them. I have this double life. I have friends as close as any here, there. I understand the culture. I embrace that culture. I am attracted to that culture. I'm comfortable in it. In the same way that I am comfortable here, it's like having two languages in your head. And so there's always a moment when I get off the plane and I think, "Ah, oh, I'm back."
Is there ever a time when you're with somebody on one side or the other, for example, some Israelis or some Palestinians, and you're expected to toe their line? Do you know what I'm talking about? You know, that you,
of course, yeah, all yeah, the time.
Yeah, and how do you get around that?
I always say I'm a journalist. I keep quiet if they yell, but I keep my own counsel. And it is possible to do that. It is possible. And it's possible to do it carefully in your reporting. But you will always make somebody mad. You will. And I don't engage in political arguments very often in those circumstances when it is that fraught. I just don't.
How do you get out of, you say, a Freudian approach? So what does this mean to you?
You can. It's so easy to do your journalist mode. And then what? And then? Look, as a journalist for this long, you do learn how to keep your opinions to yourself. And that is the wisest approach in any story, not just Israel-Palestine, but every story I cover. You just keep your opinions to yourself.
When you get all of these awards, you've had these tons of awards. How does that make you feel? Does it spoil you? Does it you just fell? I mean, what happened?
Well, I'll tell you, it's odd. I have been saying lately, I guess I'm just a late bloomer. The truth of the matter is all that stuff happened way late in my career. I went for years being a correspondent without any recognition, which was fine. And so that it has happened this late, we're talking about the last 4 or 5 years, you're kind of past the point where it's nice. I won't discount that. It is nice. But you can put it in perspective at this point. It won't change my reporting, hardly changes my relationship with National Public Radio, so that's nice. It's nicer in some ways for NPR because for them, they understand that they have put us out there, supported us, raised the money to do it. And so it's more than an individual award. You know, it was Kelly McEvers and I, my colleague in Beirut, who won that award. But really, it's NPR who won that award. It is their choice to have us there, their choice to support us in what we're doing there.
So what's the difference, Deborah Amos, between being an NPR person on the ground and being a ABC person on the ground?
Oh, you have context. You have places to put your reporting. You have an audience that you can speak to in a way that adds depth. You don't have to start with, you know, 2,000 years ago, a band of swarthy men. You can move much further ahead in your coverage.
You get more time.
You get more time. You know, there's all kinds of shows. There's just more airspace to explain a story. And, you know, Syria, we just keep getting to do it and explaining why it's important. It's the most important story in the region. Where are you seeing that much coverage? You seeing it on the network? No, you don't. In the newspapers, yes. But I would argue that we probably have done that story more extensively than anybody else. That is a commitment from NPR.
The old days, the New York Times was the Bible or the Washington Post, and the radio sort of followed it. I notice, by the way, that it's more like ping pong now, that I can see NPR doing a story and then reading it in the Times the next day.
I love it when it's that progression.
Yeah. And then sometimes it's the other
way. It's the other way.
You mentioned something before. You made a friend you were traveling with, a cameraman or something, who stood up and... How much does that kind of thing count? Do you find yourself getting thrown into, you know, friendly relationships? I don't mean sexual, by the way. I mean, but friendly relationships in which somebody becomes very important to you and becomes a sort of traveling companion.
That happens in a lot of dangerous situations. Just in this past deployment, I was with another correspondent from a newspaper. She was going into Aleppo. She said, "Can you back me up?" I said, "I'd be happy to." She texted me as she crossed the border. And when I didn't hear from her, I texted her and said, "Where are you?" I didn't have to do that, but you do it for each other. I think that that's the part of the story that even your editors don't really understand, that you do have this bond with people who do what you do. You end up staying at the same hotels. You end up running into each other in the same stories. And you talk about them at dinner. You're the people who relax for an hour at 11 o'clock after everybody's filed. Those relationships are really very important. Otherwise, it's a very lonely life to be out there. You know, sometimes I'm walking down the street in a place like Gaziantep or Antakya in southern Turkey, and I say to myself, I live in a small Turkish town. I don't know anybody in this town, but I live here. I know who the dry cleaner is, and I know the guy who runs the pharmacy. It's kind of like my neighborhood in the Upper West Side, but I don't really live here. And so those correspondents end up being a bit of my family, and I to them. You know, there'll be think tank people who come in. I know when they're coming. They'll tell me they're coming. That adds to the celebration. Oh, boy. You know, somebody else to talk to at dinner incessantly about the story that we're all covering.
Well, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are unlikely to have fellow correspondents covering the same thing next to each other, helping each other. Who's NPR's competition that they might say, hey, you let them get the story at the same time you got it?
Oof, that's a really hard question.
Probably is no one, right?
Here's what's different about us. You know, there are some stories that don't exactly work on the radio, and then you have to figure out what to do about that. And now that we have the web, sure. I find I'm a little freer, and I can write things on the web that I used to say, I don't know how to do this on the radio. Because of the medium we work in, we often are out there by ourselves simply because we need different things. I need to record sound. I need scenes. I need characters. I need to meet people. I need to hang out longer. I can't even really work with a photographer because I hate those clicks in my audio tracks. Mm-hmm. So I have been working with a photographer, and I say, you can go in after me, but not with me because you're distracting to me because you are looking for something that I'm not. And so you tend to not travel to the story with other correspondents because I'll jump out of the car because I'll hear something that I need and everybody else is annoyed with me. So it's just better to not go with them on a story. We really work differently, more like television than the print people in what we need. Mm-hmm. So I never think, oh boy, the New York Times is going to get that story before me. I think, even if they are in the same place, I'm going to do it differently than they are. My lead's going to be different. My characters are going to be different, unless we're covering a news story. And then, you know, everybody does it pretty much the same.
NPR is sort of famous for having a lot of people at the other end. We don't do much with NPR here because when we have, they grab one of our reporters and they send something back 16 times. You know, they want something else done. How about you? Do they let you do your thing?
They do for the most part, but I've been doing this for a long time.
You've earned something.
And it's not even about earning. I just know how to do it. And I know how to not, make Doug spend a lot of time. He's got 5 or 6 edits in a day. He's got a lot of us to do. I know the NPR format. I know where I can spread my wings and where I need to sort of stick to format. There's room for creativity in the way that we do things. There was a huge argument in the company when some reporters began to say the word I.
Interesting.
The domestic correspondent started it first. We were forbidden from doing it.
So give us an example of where an I might...
And when I crossed the border with...
How about this reporter crossed the border?
No. That's the old standard way, but that's very awkward in the way that we speak. And radio is about the way that we speak. That's how you would write that.
Sure.
But, you know, you might write, for example, when we first crossed the border with Rajan Shalabelsham, there was a time that we weren't allowed to do that. But it's more personal when you're doing a feature.
It has gotten more personal. You know, and we're running out of time, but I really wanted to ask you about your relationship with the anchors. Because sometimes there's the famous debrief, and I've heard them say to you, and Deb, what about this? That's pretty informal, too, and very good as far as I'm concerned, because you get the feeling everybody's in on it. Are the anchors different to you? I mean,
no.
They're these very famous people. And
I've known them forever, for the most part. And, you know, there are times, Steve Inskeep is infamous for this, you know you're going to do a debrief, and you kind of sketch it out. And he'll say, okay, what do you want to do?
You send him the questions, right?
Talking
points. Yeah.
Talking points, okay. Suggestions. Yeah. And he'll go, no, well, that's not what we're going to do. Just hang in there with me.
Yeah.
And he'll have an idea, and he will take you through it. And I trust him implicitly.
Before he'll take you through it, or while
you're... He'll say, okay. I like your ideas, but that's not what we're doing. Okay. We're going to do what I want to do.
Okay, good.
Okay. And he will wring things out of you that you didn't think that you had. Well, for example, the last time I was home, we were going to talk about, one of those overviews, four-minute pieces. We ended up going 7 minutes, and it was about what's happening to kids, Syrian kids. I had been to a school where when the kids first arrive, they only color in red. It takes them a while to see color, and they only draw bodies that have something missing. And, you know, I'd reported a little bit about it, but Steve got really interested in it. And We ended up doing a 7-minute two-way, which is unusual for National Public Radio. And this is one of those occasions where he said, yeah, I like what you're doing, but let's throw it out. I'm going to do what I want to do.
He's got a lot of power, doesn't he?
Well, because he's good.
Yeah.
And what he wanted to do was concretize what it means when 60,000 people, and that was the number at that point, 60,000 people die. That's a number. We hear that number. We don't know what it means. And that was his idea. Let's find a way to make that real. And
More than the Blitz, by the way.
Is that right?
I think it is.
It's an extraordinary number. And now we could be as high as 120.
Yeah.
But by the next day, I knew he was right. I was getting emails from the president of the company who said, I understand Syria in a new way. You know,
isn't that nice?
He was right about what he wanted to do. And because he's a host, he understands the two-way format probably better than we do as correspondents, because that's what he does. He's got authors, you know, he's talking to people all the time. So he knows how to shape that kind of a conversation.
Well, you've done some of that in your career, hosting.
I have.
Yes. And I guess the natural question everybody out there would like me to ask you is, would you rather be doing that than this?
No. I'll do some this summer. I'm going to guest host On Point in Boston, and I'll be happy to do it. It's a nice break. But first of all, in Morning Edition, you know you have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I like being in the field. I'm happier in the field than being a host.
Yeah. Do you have any fights with anybody ever? Are you a fighting person? Anybody ever annoy you?
All the time. You get tired on the road and you get grumpy and, you know, decisions annoy you. But no, I don't yell. It's all internalized. And, you know,
that's bad for you, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I come home, I go to the gym, I take it out on my husband who was sitting in the studio and is smiling. And then I go back, you know, I have enough rest and I'm done.
Amazing. So this has been a tremendous career for you. I mean, you know, and there's nobody who listens to NPR who doesn't know your work. How do you keep your head on straight so that you don't get too carried away with yourself?
I don't even think about it. I mean, when you read those long introductions, I'm embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just Deb. You know, I go out, I do my job, I come back. You know, bad things happen to me, good things happen to me. I don't really think about it. I really don't. You can ask my husband. I really don't.
Deborah Amos, do you ever think about retirement and what that might be like for you?
Oh, that's always a touchy subject. You know, I got that...
me too. I'm 72.
I got that Lifetime Achievement Award, and I said, I'm too young for that. Come on.
Yeah.
Look, it has to come. And even now, you know, when I'm in the field, I always say I can outwork any 25-year-old, but I can't run as fast as I used to. I don't take the risks that I used to because I can't get back out of them. You know, this year, Don McCullum, one of the most famous war photographers, went to Aleppo at 76. He had been in retirement. He'd been watching the news, and he somehow felt he didn't understand what was going on, so he went. And he took beautiful photographs. And it makes you think there is something about experience that makes you good at what you do. And he said, but I felt like a turtle. I had to wear a flak jacket, and I knew if anything bad happened, I was cooked.
When the Second World War was over, there were a whole bunch of people who were out of work, reporters and others who were out of work. You know, does that ever occur to you that that could happen to you?
Certainly, especially at a time of shrinking budgets. I think it is quite possible that those decisions can be made, and long careers are seen actually as a bad thing rather than a good thing. There's a lot of young people who want to be in the business, and, you know, you can see that NPR favors sort of the young, and so does every company that is looking at journalism. They work harder, they work longer, they work cheaper.
And their demographic is always an issue. We hear in NPR the average age of the listener is going up and up.
Indeed. And I think a lot of media companies are having that trouble, which is why there is such a push to be on the web. You know, nobody knows you're a dog on the internet, and nobody knows that you're close to retirement age on the internet either. So there is also that to think about.
Well, you're wonderful. Thank you so much. Our guest has been, of course, the fabulous Deborah Amos, award-winning foreign correspondent for NPR, the 2013 James H. Ottaway Senior Professor of Journalism at the State University of New York at New Paltz. Thank you, Deb. I'm Alan Chartok.
Nice to be here.
Thank you.
been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.